Right. Here we go. So this is the 10th of July 2009. My name is Rohan Mukherjee and I'm with Mr. Abhay Anand, who is the Additional Director General in the police of the government of Bihar, in charge of the Bihar Military Police. Mr. Abhay Anand, could you briefly tell us your professional background and your involvement in the Bihar government to date?
My name is Abhay Anand. I belong to the 1977 batch of the Indian Police Service. Was allotted the Bihar cadre. In the year 2005, when this present government came into existence, I was the additional Director General of Police looking after the intelligence. And then a couple of months later, I was also made the Additional Director General of Police Headquarters. So I held two very important charges of intelligence and the headquarters, which looks after the policy matters, both regards the intelligence part as well as the operational part. In that sense and in that capacity, both the capacities, I was almost handling the entire operational as well as the intelligence part of the police department, with the DGP as the head of the police department.
And when you came into this position, what did you perceive to be the major issues or challenges that were priorities?
The priority which was handed down to us, and particularly in the intelligence aspect as well as the operational aspect, was kidnapping. Kidnapping for ransom was a major issue inflicting the state of Bihar. In fact, it was an issue all along during the election campaign also. The government wanted that this menace of kidnapping for ransom be checked at all cost, and it was prepared to do anything because it was an election promise of the government, and the government wanted that kidnapping for ransom and of course major law and order issues, which included murders, also be checked.
And so the government put these issues on your agenda?
Yes, the government did, in fact. It was, I don't think it was in a written format, but informally during discussions, we were told in the police department to pick out these issues, especially kidnapping for ransom, and then other violent offences, for example, dacoities. It's a offence which is very peculiar to this part of the world. Robberies, murders, heinous murders, then mass murders, caste riots. These were issues which the government addressed in the law and order issues.
And what makes you think that at that moment the time was ripe for such reform? Why had it not happened before that?
I wouldn't be able to give you a very good and definite answer to this, because that is basically a government policy. And the government policies are dictated and created by the government in power. That is the political government in power. But I can guess that it had become a major election issue. The elections were fought on law and order. People had talked about Jungle Raj being there in the state of Bihar. And somebody came up and said, I'll be able to get rid of the Jungle Raj. I think the government was primarily concerned first with this.
So there was no real pre-existing strategy to deal with this problem when you came into office?
Oh, nothing.
And were you able to rely on any experiences or any observations of other states in India or other countries in dealing with this?
No, nothing. It was an idea which I was working on as a district superintendent of police in a very small way. It went unnoticed because it was handled at a very small level in a district. But then those experiences I had crystallized, and the logic behind that experience was simple. It said, let 95 cases not be detected, but if you are able to detect 5 cases, then ensure that the perpetrators of those crimes which have been detected are punished, and punished as expeditiously as possible.
Thank you, sir. So you initiated a number of important, or your team, your department initiated a number of important changes. And we don't have time to speak about all of them, but if you could look back and think of the most important reforms that your department initiated in terms of their impact on society, or in terms of widening the scope for further reform, what would they be?
The first important point that comes to my mind when I started doing all this in collaboration with my colleagues is that the basic principle was, whatever the police does will be absolutely legal. All the actions will be guided through the courts. All our efforts will be directed through the courts. There won't be any action of the police which will not be associated with the courts. So whether it be cancellation of bail of the criminals who abuse bail, who jump bail, or the trial of criminals, or even the investigation part, would be fair and done very legalistically, so that the results that we get have the stamp of legality on it.
So before we get into the details of specific reforms, if we could talk a little bit about how your department was able to build support for reforms, because before that point, as has been pointed out by people in the media and other places, the image of the Bihar police was not the most positive one. So were you able to rely on any individuals or groups of individuals to build support for your reforms in that period?
Well, the activity that I took up, for example, speedy trial, is a word which is now almost everyone in Bihar knows, or cancellation of bail. These activities were not carried out by our cutting edge officers, people who are called the district superintendents of police, or even below them, the deputy superintendents of police. They just had no idea of how a trial is conducted, because the feeling was getting a trial conducted is not a part of their mandate. Their mandate ends with sending the case to the court of law. For them, it was the end of the matter. I had to literally pull them out of this state of mind and tell them, look, you can even pursue this in the court of law. It's a very easy process. You may not be aware of it. I'll teach you how to do it. Just do it and you will see the results. Initially, we have 40 district superintendents of police, because there are 40 districts here in the state. Each one of them was initially very reluctant, because they thought, sir, this is not our job, why should we do it? And I had to convince them. So this is the area where my managerial prowess of leading the men into an area where they thought it was not their activity, galvanizing them, first convincing them, then galvanizing them, and then making them enjoy this activity so that they did it so willingly. I didn't have to do much later on. But the initial 3-4 months was a bit of a problem for me.
So you, in terms of creating that sense of mission among the people in your department, among the district superintendents, did you rely on any special incentives, rules or management techniques to achieve that?
No, I won't say that there were incentives. Initially, I had to first convince them that this is a part of your job. One. Second, that this process would give you wonderful results which you have not got so far. This is an activity which if you do, you can see tangible results immediately. And in the other activities, those tangible results are not seen immediately. So, trying to convince them, and I must give a lot of credit to all my district superintendents of police because they had faith in me. And when I talked to them, I talked to them very passionately. Each one of them responded so well that the results that we got were just astounding. Nobody had expected these results. I had not expected those results when I started, because this was something absolutely new. It had never been done before. They got us the results. The state benefited. And finally, I would say when the results started coming in, then there were some incentives like who is the best, who's got the maximum. And then there was a sense of a competition. It was a very healthy competition amongst the district superintendents of police as to who would do better. And they would share amongst themselves their experiences. I knew that when I talked to each one of them, and I would talk to each one of them every day, right from 9 in the evening to 12 in the night, 3 hours, all the 40 SPs I would be talking to them on a telephone, sharing whatever they had done and guiding them and helping them to move on. And then I later came to know that all of them were sharing experiences with the other guy and helping each other, trying to make them understand what are the practical implements that they have adopted to achieve results. I felt happy. It was working, yeah.
And were you able to institutionalize this kind of an approach, or was it more informal, the consultation?
No, it was very informal, and to the extent that it's not even documented.
I see. And at the same time, you said, you know, you tried to involve the courts, your department tried to involve the courts in everything. So you must have had to rely to some extent on the support of the judiciary in doing that.
I won't say I tried to elicit the support of the judiciary, but then at a concept level, the government held meetings with the officers of the court, and in fact there was a seminar conducted in Patna itself. This happened sometime in 2007, I don't remember the month. The second half of 2007, and I think this was a seminar which was unique in the sense that the dais was shared by the Chief Justice of the Patna High Court, the Chief Minister, the Chief Secretary, all the district judges, all the public prosecutors, all the district superintendents of police, which means anybody who is a stakeholder in the fight against crime. And I don't remember having read a dais being shared by the judiciary and the executive simultaneously. I think this was a good signal which went down and which benefited us.
And how do you think the members of the judiciary reacted to this new approach that the police department had come up with?
I can't use the word that they helped us. No, they are not supposed to be helping us. They're supposed to be. But then, you know, basically it boils down to a trial gets delayed because the witnesses don't turn up. And it is my job to produce a witness as a policeman. It is my job. And this is what I put into the minds of the district superintendents of police. I said, just do this, get your witnesses, put them before the court, let them depose whatever they want to, but then insist that the witnesses come to the court. This is what we did. We did not let the courts go dry. We produced our witnesses and we got our results.
So, but that must have increased the caseload that these people had to deal with.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. But they, I think to that extent, there was no hesitation on the part of the lower judiciary, because they had also been waiting for witnesses to come. The witnesses had not, you know, the traditionally the witnesses, not many would turn up. Nobody took interest. It was for the first time that in the name of speedy trial, and this is exactly what we used to do, get the witnesses. You know, the major issue used to be the witnesses, like the police officers and the doctors, they won't come. So I ensured that the police officers would go, and they did go, and they said that they were happy to be deposing in the court.
Okay. In terms of popular support for your reforms or for your department's new policies, did you take any specific steps? Did your department reach out to the people?
No, not exactly. What we did was, it was like this. This used to be a monthly exercise. So, on the last day of the month, it was my job to collect data from all the districts, compile it in the form of figures, and if there was a sensational crime which the courts had delivered judgment upon, then give it to the media. But on the last day, the data used to be compiled as to how many cases under what type of offense, how many people got convicted for how many years or maybe fine, whatever. So that used to be compiled in a very standard format. That used to happen on the last day. The media would know exactly at 7, if you go to the office of the ADG headquarters, you will get this data. They would all come in, even without my requesting them to come. I would hand them over the data, and then the next day the media would cover it. So it became a routine sort of a thing. Every first of the month, the media would cover how many people got convicted. So the people started knowing, and this word speedy trial became an adage sort of, and people started talking about it.
So it would have, it must have helped to have good relations between the police department and the media?
To a certain extent, yes.
And yes. How were you able to cultivate that? How was your department able?
I gave you this because at the end of the month, they would come. At the, suppose a particular case ends in a conviction. Even the media had started following it up, you know, and they would keep asking me what is the date on which the judgment is going to come. And they got quite excited about it. You know, I didn't have to even tell them, look, this is happening. They picked it up and they were happy to pick it up. In fact, at times I would know more from the media than they would know from me.
And so over time, the department was able to build up the level of popular support.
Yes, I would say yes.
And do you see any challenges in maintaining that level? Could something cause it to go down again?
Well, right now I'm not associated with that activity anymore. Therefore, I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly what's happening.
Sure. So if we talk about the specifics, like you said, the speedy trial is now almost an institutionalized aspect of the police. For the people listening to this interview, if you could just briefly talk about the goal of this reform.
As I said, when the elections took place in 2005, containing crime, doing away with this concept of Jungle Raj, this was a popular phrase which was being used in the campaign. And when the government came, it was number one on the priority agenda. Contain the law and order situation, since it was promised to the people. So the goal was basically contain the law and order situation, get the fear psyche out of the people, people's mind. People were very fearful. After 7 in the night, you'd find almost the streets deserted. So the government was very keen that this should go. That was the goal. And when I picked up this concept of trial, as I said right at the beginning of my interview, we had to do everything through the courts, very legalistically. No extra legal methods to be adopted. This was, I thought, the only way out. Get the criminals who get caught, go after them, produce the witnesses in a court, and, you know, not only ensuring that conviction is made, but ensuring that it is done so expeditiously that he is just nonplussed. If a man commits an offense today, and if he can be convicted within 30 days, then imagine the amount of mental shaking that he gets if he feels, if you get caught today, 30 days down the line, you are convicted. The amount of impact that it will have on the mind of criminals is for anybody to guess.
Sir, how did that figure of 30 days compare to the previous time period for trial?
Oh, there is just no comparison. There is just no comparison. But when I say 30 days, I don't say exactly 30, but see, in our system, we have a concept of a prosecution report being filed in 90 days. If you do it, then you're supposed to be very efficient. There are instances after instances where in kidnappings, from the day of kidnapping, and I'm not saying from the day of the launching of the prosecution, from the day of kidnapping, people have been convicted to life imprisonment within 90 days.
And what unforeseen obstacles did you encounter along the way? Were there anything that you didn't plan for in implementing this kind of a strategy?
No, as long as I was doing it, there was just no impediment. There was just no impediment. It was going very smoothly. Everyone was cooperating. Everyone was happy. People were happy. People were supporting it.
Sir, there were also some reports of a very innovative use of a clause in the Arms Act that came about. Now, that also, I mean, is in some senses a reform, even though it was already in the law, but to use it was innovative. Could you talk a little bit about that?
It's like this, Rohan. I did not create a law. I don't have the authority to create law. I just use the law which already exists. In fact, I did not request the government to create laws to ensure that law and order and crime situation improves. You've talked about the Arms Act. I can tell you very simply, I got this idea about the Arms Act because of three factors. One, the three statements are, one, all major violent offenses are committed through arms, firearms. It can be a regular firearm, it can be irregular firearm. Number two, all the criminals who figure in any violent activity are one time or the other accused of Arms Act cases, which means having been found in possession of illegal firearms. This is a fact. as a policeman working in Bihar, I knew it. This was the second fact. And the third fact was, of all the offenses, the easiest to get convicted is an Arms Act case, because it's just simple possession of firearm and the witnesses involved are policemen. There is less likelihood of a policeman being getting threatened by a criminal. Suppose I get a kidnapping case tried against him, the witnesses are all private citizens. The chances of their getting threatened is quite high. So I picked out the Arms Act and first went for the Arms Act cases. And when the convictions started streaming in the Arms Act cases, then I opened out into the other offenses of kidnapping. And because I had to first prove the point that convictions, if I want, I can get it speeded up and get a good result. That only helped to, you know, build confidence in my district superintendents of police. Yes, if we do it, we can get results.
Then once the results started coming in, was there any concern specifically in relation to the Arms Act provision that it might lead to too much power in the hands of the police since they were all police witnesses?
Rohan, it's like this. There is no way in which the police can arrogate powers to itself, especially if the police decides to put this constraint upon itself of doing everything in a very legalistic manner. There is no way in which you can do it. The system is such.
Yes. Is there any other reform that comes to your mind that took place in that time in your department?
Yes. There is one more. It's very interesting. You know, what happened was when the government came into power in 2005, this present government which is functioning, the police department was woefully short of constables. The shortage was to the extent of about 12,000 in a force of 35,000. It was woefully short. We knew at the being at the top of the operational part of the police department, we knew, and I knew especially, that there is no way in which I can get this shortage made up in the next 3 years. It involves the process of recruitment, of training, and only after the training these constables could have been used for operational purposes. That would have taken us 3 years, recruitment and training. So this was a big constraint. What came to my mind was very outlandish. It was proposed, it was accepted by the government, and it was accepted very fast. The idea was, can we take retired army people on contract, because I didn't need to train them. And in the army, the constables retire at an early age compared to the police. We go for retirement at the age of 58 for the constables. There they retire at the age of 45. So I thought they would be good to work for another 2 years at least till I get my men. So it was contract given to retired army men, taken on contract. So for the first time, this concept of contract policing, well, this had never come. People taken on contract to do policing work. And I think it was a win-win situation for the army people and the Bihar police. And I can tell you, even the Ministry of Defense, when they came to know that we had done this in the Bihar police, they were so happy that they circulated a letter to all the states. The Ministry of Defense looks after the welfare of its retired men. So they want to get them re-employed somewhere. So this, they thought this was the best re-employment that could be possible for the retired constables of the army, retired jawans of the army. They circulated this as an example to all the states saying, Bihar has done this, could you do it? And now a lot of other states have done this. We called our group. It was a group of about 5,000 people, SAP, the subsidiary armed police, SAP we call it, and SAP was such a big hit in this state. People were terribly scared of this. Army ka aadmi hai. That used to be the concept.
And so were they deployed mainly in Patna or outside?
No, it was deployed all over the state. We had decided to use it only for operational purposes against the Naxals as well as the criminals, organized crime.
And the training that army jawans would have gone through would have been different to the conditions that policing requires?
This is a very good question. What we decided was, that is why we put them in the operational part of the policing, where the chances of encounters taking place is very high. But on the legal part, they couldn't go out all by themselves. They had to be headed by our sub-inspectors who know their law. These constables are not, these jawans from the army were not expected to know the civil law. So they were always asked to be led by sub-inspectors who know the civil law, and they used to be under the direct control of these officers who knew their civil law. But on the operational side, they were par excellence.
The
organized criminal gangs and even the extremist groups, they used to fear this.
So did this arrangement out in the field create any problems in terms of a conflict of authority, that the operations are managed by one aspect and the legal side is managed by
fact, you'll be surprised that the sub-inspectors who headed the civil and the legal part of the police were, they used to be very happy heading this armed unit of what we call the SAP, because they would feel confident that if we get into an area where the chances of encounters are high, and they used to be threatened. I mean, there is a possibility of an encounter and firing taking place. So they always wanted some force on which they could rely to even protect them. So on the contrary, they felt happy.
And the army officers were willing to take direction from the...
No, we did not take the officers. It was just the jawans. So very deliberately, we did not take the officers.
I see. Okay. And in implementing this, were you again given
absolutely
a free rein?
Absolutely smooth. No issues. In fact, it's such a big hit that even after the recruitment has been made and the training has been done, we are still carrying on with SAP. The initial idea was, in that period when the recruitment and training goes on, could we have these people? And the idea was that, but I think they're still carrying on.
I'll move on now to a slightly different but related topic, which is deployment, by which we mean organizing people to get a job done. Moving money and resources where they're required. So in relation to this, there are a few questions that we have. Firstly, finding talent to design and manage reforms is always a challenge in any department. So what kind of challenges did your department face at the highest levels in creating a team, locating people to carry out these reforms?
Unfortunately, I do not have the privilege of creating a team. It is not a privilege that I have or we have at the top. The team is there, whether you like it or you don't like it. You can't create your own team. So the challenge is, can I or we motivate that team to work out that challenge? This was indeed a managerial challenge. I think I took it up. I've told you in my interview earlier, everyone loved to do it. You know, it's how much of confidence that your men have in you. How can I say that somebody is not good? If he's not good, I think it is my fault if he's not good. It's my job to make him good.
So that addresses the issue of motivation. In terms of capacity, did you take any steps to build capacity in those?
Yes, I did. In the same vein as motivating people, I knew some of them. It's very simple. Every individual has his own capacity. But then building up the capacity was also a managerial challenge which I undertook. And it was a very informal process in which I would talk to them. I would discuss things with them. Not only tell them, just keep doing it. No. When he would say, he'll come up with a problem. So his problem has to be tackled and sorted out. They're all well-read people. So I would just tell them, look into this aspect of law, read it, and then come back to me. So they would come and discuss, and they're all very intelligent people. You just motivate them and give them that space to think for themselves. I think they can all do it.
And were any steps taken to ensure the sustainability at that time of the things that were going on in the department?
You know, Rohan, what I believe in is sustainability is a matter of evolution. If you do a process, each individual who's working with you towards a particular goal, he doesn't go strictly according to your way of doing it. He develops his own way. And each way is a route to that success. I have very firmly believed that if a particular route is taken and it's a good route, like the process of evolution, that sticks and that grows. The routes which somebody else has taken, and if it is not good, it will not survive and therefore it will die out. So only those routes will sustain which are good, and that is what I believed in. I cannot say, oh look, this is the route and I want this has to be sustained. Sustainability will come through a long process of evolution. Things which are good will sustain.
So in that sense, the external environment as well plays a role in
Yes, there are a lot of factors. How can I predetermine that this is the route and this will sustain? I cannot predetermine it. I've only given the roles. I've only given the goals. Now, each individual, as I said, there are 40 district superintendents of police, and each one tries his own experiment. And I gave them that free space to try their own experiments, and they would share those experiments not only among themselves but also with me, and I would be very happy learning from them. But then I knew all these experiments are not going to succeed. Some of them will, some of them will not. Which succeeded will sustain, which did not succeed will not sustain.
So do you think there is any way to increase that rate of success of the experiment succeeding, or is it entirely up to chance?
No, I will not leave it to chance. The goals are set, those goals need to be set higher and higher. And that is where people at my level count. But then there must be a lot of free space for the participants to do their activity.
So, and by goals, do you refer to the sort of broad mission statements of the police department, or more specific statistics?
No, very, very specific. For example, if I say speedy trial, that is a goal. I'll have to create new ideas again. As a leader, I'll have to create new ideas and sell those ideas.
So, we have a few questions about situations that reformers and leaders in other places have experienced. Not all of them may be applicable, but since you were involved in the management of people, I would just like to ask a few of these questions to you.
Please.
So in some places we found that there is a pressure to provide jobs in a department, in any service agency, to important people or difficult factions, or even, you know, family members of leaders and things like that. Some of the people you've hired may have felt this pressure, or in your department there may have been this pressure. Did this exist? Was this a problem that you faced?
See, if you're working in a sociological system, you can't be insulated. I accept that. Not only this type of pressure, each individual has got a right to put up his demand. That's how I take it. If he is a constable, he has a right to put up a demand. He can come individually, he can come in a group as well. If he represents the people of the state as a constituency, he has a right to put up his demand. So he has a right to his viewpoint. Now, as an officer who is supposed to be doing things according to law and according to a system, he will have to consider everything and see what he has to do. Nobody can force you to do something. Nobody can. In a democracy, nobody can. So I take it this way. It is his right to put up a demand, and it is my duty to consider it and do whatever is proper.
Thank you. Another issue that often comes up, and might be also, it is very relevant to policing, is there are many elements in society that have a vested interest in bad governance. Smugglers, criminals, people like that. A lot of them you've already named in your interview. In your efforts to improve, in your department's efforts to improve the police force, did you encounter resistance from such groups? And how did you address that?
Well, the resistance, I did not feel it directly. But yes, there is an indirect resistance. It's very invisible. You can feel it at times. But I can assure you, I did not feel it directly. It was not visible to me. I cannot deny that the invisible resistance is not there.
So, I don't mean to probe too far, but when you say invisible resistance, is it just a sense in the society, in the media, or...?
No, they have their own ways of tackling people, tackling these efforts like speedy trial.
Mm-hmm.
They have their own ways of doing it. I can't deny it, because each individual has the right to defend himself in whichever way he wants to. But then the issue is, this can be tackled only at the level of the government. It can't be tackled at the level of officers.
So you think a broad policy level response is required?
Yes. Yes.
I guess
I can assure you on one aspect. Even this group that you have named, the group which does all this illegal activity, to which this process of speedy trial was antithetical, even they accepted that the process which was adopted was very fair. So there was no animus against either the process or against the individual who had created this process. That was very obvious. There was no animus. There was nothing personal against, because there was nothing personal against any one of them. It was against a bad practice, a bad illegal activity going on. And it was being done very fairly, very transparently. Everyone was given a chance to defend himself. And then if you get convicted, so be it.
So if I may ask, how were you able to obtain that feedback from?
Not only in my effort here, but even otherwise earlier also, working at a junior level as a district superintendent of police, I have had this feedback in abundance.
Right, so, just a few more questions. How important do you think is a senior officer's own background and personal management style in bringing about reforms in a department?
See, people say it's a system which works, yes. But then systems are operated by individuals. I remember having read a book which says the office of the President of the United States of America was one thing under one person and another thing under another person. That office is an office. I think the concept holds true everywhere.
So would you agree that an institution is as good as the people who occupy it?
I wouldn't say that it is only as good as the person. The system also has to work. Unless, of course, there is a person who creates a system all on his own. He is too good. But if there is a system, then the individual will also count. So you can apportion something to the individual and the rest to the system.
So it was a fairly commonplace to say that before these reforms started, the system wasn't working.
No, the system was in place. This aspect, the trial aspect, was never taken by the police. It's still not taken by the police as a part of the job. Technically, they say, no, it's not a part of the job of the police. Even today, I have not seen any reason why it should not be treated as a part of my job. What am I doing in a speedy trial? I'm just getting hold of the witnesses and producing them in a court of law. I'm not forcing anybody to pass a judgment in the form that I would like the judgment to be passed in. But I'm just forcing the pace of the process. And I'm sure everyone would like the process to be, speeded up. Who would like a trial to go on for years? No system would like that. I'm just doing that.
So in a minor detail related question on that, would you have had to provide additional witness protection when you were doing this?
As long as I was doing it, I don't remember having had to provide a lot of protection to witnesses. Yes, in a few stray cases, yes, some of them demanded. But on the contrary, I'll share my experience with you. This is on the contrary to what you feel. There were witnesses who came down saying, let my case be opened, I would like to depose. And they're so eager to depose. Because their father had been killed, their brother had been killed, their wives had been raped. They would like to depose. It was on the contrary.
I see. So often people talk about the need for a reformer or a reform-minded individual or a department, leadership in a department, to articulate a vision of or a storyline to help the reforms move forward, to help society progress. How important is this step, do you think?
I'm not saying that this was the most important step, but yes, this was a departure from the past. It was definitely a departure from the past. It caught the attention of a lot of people. It caught the attention of the entire state, in fact. And people started talking about speedy trial as if this was something like a new toy which has come and everyone starts exploring it. I don't know how important it is, but it definitely did give us results. It definitely improved the situation. It will also require a lot of refinements as things go on, because you just can't keep carrying on with this speedy trial. It will need to be reformed. As people say, if you keep doing what you were doing, you will get what you already got. So you will have to keep editing and reforming it and changing it.
So there's also a sense in which the speedy trial issue addressed the most immediate concern in pertaining to law and order at the time. And so once the relatively easier cases to try were taken out of the way, now the more intractable issues are left? And has the department tried to address beyond the...
No, I don't think this perception is true. This perception is not true. In fact, we did not pick out the easy ones. Arms Act, yes. Initially, we picked out the Arms Act cases, but that was, partly it is true that those are easy cases to try. You have very few witnesses and almost sure of getting a conviction. But then Arms Act is there. We have tried all types of cases and very difficult ones. A lot of them have ended in conviction. Some of them have also ended in acquittal where we couldn't get the evidence. So this perception that initially you tried all the easier ones and now it is the difficult ones are coming, I don't think that perception is true.
So and with regard to the Arms Act cases, is it 3 years is the maximum prison time?
If it is it's not a regular firearm, then it is 3 years. But if it is a regular firearm, then it is about 6 or 7 years.
So do you think the department has a longer term view on those who go through the justice system and come out at the other end of 3 years or 7 years?
Yes, we tried an experiment. Unfortunately, it did not succeed. We wanted to rehabilitate a lot of them. The government did that. It was done with a lot of fanfare. I was also there as a part of the system. But somehow it did not succeed. I mean, as I said, in the evolution process, this did not consolidate, and therefore, I don't know why it did not succeed. I'm sorry I couldn't go into the reasons. But we tried it, did not succeed.
So one of the last operational questions that we have is about obtaining information. When leaders make decisions, they look at various options. But one of the problems they face is obtaining ideas. They may even have ideas, but they're often too busy to collect information on which to base their ideas. So where did you turn to for information or advice or feedback on the things that were going on?
Rohan. This country has so much of population. The state also has so much of population that we don't need to collect information. A man who is sensitive enough, who's worked in this state, his feeling, the gut itself, is a lot of information, and nothing is wrong about that information, because there's so much of data available all around. You don't need to compile it. If you want to draw conclusions, it is there. The conclusions are very obvious. You don't need to be really meticulous about it. If you want to go into nuances of those conclusions, yes, you may need to have data. But then the very broad things, like Arms Act, is a very broad thing. Any policeman who's worked for 30 years in this state will tell you straight away the conclusions that I drew. Those are so broad conclusions, you don't need to collect data. Yes, but if you want to get into a lot of planning and micro level, I think you would need to collect it. Unfortunately, we do collect some data, yes, we do, but the authenticity of the data and the credibility of the data is not very high.
So that touches on another issue that a lot of leaders face in other contexts, which is that when you want to reform an institution, but the only source of information on that institution is a reporting unit within that institution, and then there are problems of reliability and credibility. Do you have any thoughts on how that can be got around?
You know, the problems are at such a macro level that I think even if you touch the first layer of the macro level, you would have done wonders.
Thank you. So just in closing, as I mentioned before we started our interview, that we tried this. Our program helps leaders share their experiences and innovations in addressing the challenges that arise from building new states, but also fundamentally reforming existing ones. And we're all in building this resource, we're always looking for new things to add to it. So if there's anything we've missed in this interview or I've neglected to ask you, would you like to add anything at this point?
No, I think it's a good exercise that you're doing. I was sitting here. My vision is within the four walls of the state. I've drawn my experiences, my data from the state. The problem belongs to the state. I also belong to the state. But yes, if I can share something similar from other states, maybe I'll be able to do a better job. So concept-wise, it's good. But then I have a feeling that if I just keep thinking about where I am, here and now, I am here, I am in a now situation, and I just concentrate, close my eyes and concentrate, I think I know where the problems lie and how to reach to a solution. Sharing a lot of experience from all over, the difficulty arises when you have so many inputs that it's difficult to save the relevant from the irrelevant.
Thank you very much, sir.